As Jesus came declaring the kingdom of God, he's challenging and confronting some of the Jewish misguided notions. They expected an ethnocentric kingdom, one of only Jewish people, but Jesus has come to be a light to lighten the Gentiles as well. In Matthew 15, he comments on the greatness of a Gentile woman's faith. In Matthew 8, he heals the servant of a Roman army officer, and then turns to the Jewish crowd and says about that officer, "I have not found such great faith in all Israel." In this, Jesus is going against the flow of Jewish thought. The kingdom God's planning is not what they expect if outwardly it welcomes Gentiles. And if they've missed such a basic tenet of God's promise, I mean, after all, the Old Testament did promise a Messiah that would be a light to enlighten the Gentiles. If they've missed that, then surely they've missed the point in other areas as well. And so the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 through 7 provides numerous examples of Jesus correcting their misconceptions about what true righteousness really looks like. But they think righteousness looks like the scribes and Pharisees. But in the Beatitudes, he explains righteousness isn't proud. It's not puffed up. It's meek and merciful and pure-hearted. And those who are truly righteous, they don't brag. They hunger and thirst for more righteousness, even to the point of being persecuted by those who reject true righteousness. He calls them back to their missionary purpose, reminding them that the children of God are like candles placed on a lampstand and lifted up so that their light illuminates the dark world around them and brings glory to God. True righteousness, he says, is not about external obedience, but about internal character, right? He uses the examples, it's good not to commit adultery or to murder, but if you've got lust and anger in your heart, you're already guilty. If you hand out charity, or you pray loudly, or you fast publicly for attention, that's meaningless. All of this teaching was contrary to the behavior of the supposed religious elites, the Pharisees. It was also delivered in a manner that was so authoritative, it was shocking. It's hard to overestimate just how astonishing and controversial that sermon was. Perhaps the single verse that is the main theme of the Sermon on the Mount is Matthew 5:20, where Jesus said, "Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." Saying that was like tossing a live theological hand grenade into the crowd. I mean, listen to their reaction to his preaching. Matthew 7, 28 and 29, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. "And it came to pass when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes." They were absolutely stunned by both the content and the delivery of the message, shocked by both what Jesus said and also how Jesus said it. As Jesus challenged the status quo and threatened to shake the foundation of their teaching, he likely was not winning many friends among the scribes and Pharisees by the message. Instead, they became a source of constant controversy and conflict during the remainder of Jesus' ministry. They didn't like being challenged. There's probably no single issue which more exemplifies that conflict between Jesus and the Jewish leaders than that of the Sabbath day. They had taken the simple command in the Ten Commandments, right? Don't work on the Sabbath day. And they'd started developing new commands based on what they considered work to be. Now, you can understand how that happened. Somebody asked, you know, what counts as work? And you'd get an answer like, plowing. Plowing is work. But then what counts as plowing? Well, moving a chair a few inches is plowing because you might accidentally drag it across the ground and create a rut. Harvesting is work. So if you pull a gray hair out, it counted as harvesting. That's working on the Sabbath day. Bearing a burden, right? Carrying something is work. Not always. And they said you could carry something small like a needle unless you were a tailor. If a tailor carried a needle, that's work. If a scribe carried a writing quill, that's work. You see how debilitating such rules could become. You couldn't blow out a candle because that's work. And if you accidentally left a window open and the wind blew out a candle, you have done work. You've broken Sabbath law. This is why Jesus said this kind of system in Matthew 23:4. He says, they bind heavy burdens, grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders. The idea being, they've created extra biblical tradition that was so tedious that they took the simple command, don't work, and they turned it into its own kind of work. Now, as Jesus confronts this, he's not subtle about it. I think sometimes we get this idea that Jesus was sort of just tragically controversial because he was misunderstood, when in reality he was purposefully controversial in order to make himself understood. So in Mark 3, for example, the Pharisees are watching him to see if he would heal, if he'd work on the Sabbath day. And so he enters into a synagogue. He stands up front. He calls a man with a withered hand up before everyone, and he looks and he challenges them and asks, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days? That's not being quietly misunderstood, right? If, as they refuse to answer, Mark says that Jesus looked on each of them with anger because of their lack of compassion. And when he heals the man, they react by immediately plotting to murder him. There's a fabulous account in John 5 in which Jesus heals a man at the Pool of Bethesda. Now, you need to sort of visualize this. The Pool of Bethesda is tucked away on the backside of the temple in Jerusalem. And on the Sabbath day, Jesus goes there and he heals an invalid. And he tells that man, rise, take up your bed and walk. Now, this man is out there on the backside of the temple. And if he's going to walk anywhere, it's going to be through crowded streets, carrying his pallet on the Sabbath day. And if there's really any doubt in your mind that Jesus has sort of purposefully set up that scene, just go and read John 5. When the man is assaulted by the crowd who starts yelling, it's the Sabbath, you can't carry that. He just answered, the man who healed me told me I should. And so they ask, well, who told you? They didn't ask, by the way, who healed you, because the miracle was less shocking than somebody carrying a pallet through the streets on the Sabbath. Unfortunately for the crowd, Jesus hadn't told the man who he was, so that would have been the end of the story, but it's evident Jesus didn't want it to be the end of the story. He actually goes and finds the man. He doesn't accidentally bump into him. He intentionally finds him and reveals himself to him in the temple. Here's what John 5, 15 through 17 says. The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus which made him whole. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. But Jesus answered them, my Father works hitherto and I work. Here's what Jesus is saying. God is working on the Sabbath, so I am working on the Sabbath. Now, how does God work on the Sabbath? Well, the sun came up, people die on the Sabbath, people are born on the Sabbath, cuts heal, rain falls, right? His providential care for the world shows God works on the Sabbath. The Jews understood that because they even made up ways to explain it. They said, for example, right? If you carried something outside of your house like this man was doing, that's work. But the whole world is God's house, so he never carries anything outside. You know, what Jesus is essentially saying here is, to this day, God my Father is working and I am also working. He's not going to be limited by their Sabbath traditions. And frankly, it would be tragic if Jesus was. The Apostle Paul writes to the Colossians later and says of Jesus that all things were created by him and for him, and he is before all things, and by him all things consist. Literally, all things are held together by Jesus, their creator. If he is what holds your life together, you don't want him to stop working on the Sabbath day. God works on the Sabbath, and Jesus is God. And by the way, that's another example of this controversial ministry. He set up that whole scene in John 5, and now he's being assaulted in the temple courtyard on the Sabbath, accused of breaking Sabbath law, and he responded by saying that God is my Father. My Father works, right? So if there was anything in Jewish tradition more serious than Sabbath law, it was blasphemy. And so now Jesus is not only confronting their view of the Sabbath, but also their view of Jesus' own nature. Right? The next verse says, therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him because he not only had broken the Sabbath, but said also that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. Listen, Jesus is not avoiding controversy in his ministry. That was part of God's plan. Anyone who reads the Gospels for the first time will continually be thinking, this man is going to get killed by those religious leaders if it keeps going like this. And that's where this is going. Nearing the end of his earthly ministry in Matthew 21, Jesus enters the temple in Jerusalem and there's again controversy. The religious leaders ask him, you know, what gives you the authority to do miracles and to teach? And in part of the ensuing discussion, Jesus shows their rejection of his authority. And his message is part of God's grand plan of redemption, right? Their rejection of him and all of the controversy surrounding it is part of God's plan. He asks if they have read and understood the Old Testament. And then he quotes Psalm 118:22. Here it is, Matthew 21, verse 42. Jesus said unto them, did you never read in the scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner? This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. The idea is of a big building made out of stone, right? And some builders sent to the quarry to get the stone sent to the construction site. But the builders think this stone that got sent doesn't fit, right? They reject it. But ultimately, it's that stone that was supposed to be the chief cornerstone, the very first one that is laid. And that stone going down, its shape and its size is what makes every other stone fit into place in relation to that first cornerstone. Isn't that a wonderful picture of Jesus himself? All of this controversy and rejection, it's because they think Jesus doesn't fit their design. They're ready to reject him and saying this is he's useless. But ultimately, God's the architect, and it's the building is according to his design. And with God, Jesus is the cornerstone. He's the foundation. He's the very base on which everything fits. And so true righteousness finds its definition in Jesus, and Sabbath law finds its meaning in Jesus. And your charity and your prayer and your fasting, anything that you do that you think makes you righteous, it must exceed, go beyond the scribes and Pharisees, because it has to find its meaning in Jesus. This continues to be controversial to this day, but it's still true. All righteousness is based on the foundation of Jesus alone.